This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Couple Next Door by Sherry LaPena. Read for you by Kirsten Potter. 1. Anne can feel the acid churning in her stomach and creeping up her throat. Her head is swimming. She's had too much to drink. Cynthia has been topping her up all night. Anne had meant to keep herself to a limit, but she'd let things slide. She didn't know how else she was supposed to get through the evening. Now she has no idea how much wine she's drunk over the course of this interminable dinner party. She'll have to pump and dump her breast milk in the morning. Anne wilts in the heat of the summer night and watches her hostess with narrowed eyes. Cynthia is flirting openly with Anne's husband, Marco. Why does Anne put up with it? Why does Cynthia's husband, Graham, allow it? Anne is angry but powerless. She doesn't know how to put a stop to it without looking pathetic and ridiculous. They are all a little tanked. So she ignores it, quietly seething, and sips at the chilled wine. Anne wasn't brought up to create a scene, isn't one to draw attention to herself. Cynthia, on the other hand... All three of them, Anne, Marco, and Cynthia's mild-mannered husband, Graham, are watching her as if fascinated. Marco, in particular, can't seem to take his eyes off Cynthia. She leans in a little too close to Marco as she bends over and fills his glass, her clingy top cut so low that Marco's practically rubbing his nose in her cleavage. Anne reminds herself that Cynthia flirts with everyone. Cynthia has such outrageous good looks that she can't seem to help herself. But the longer Anne watches, the more she wonders if there could actually be something going on between Marco and Cynthia. Anne has never had such suspicions before. Perhaps the alcohol is making her paranoid. No, she decides. They wouldn't be carrying on like this if they had anything to hide. Cynthia is flirting more than Marco is. He is the flattered recipient of her attentions. Marco is almost too good-looking himself, with his tousled dark hair, hazel eyes, and charming smile. He's always attracted attention. They make a striking couple, Cynthia and Marco. Anne tells herself to stop it, tells herself that of course Marco is faithful to her. She knows he is completely committed to his family. She and the baby are everything to him. He will stand by her no matter what. She takes another gulp of wine, no matter how bad things get. But watching Cynthia drape herself over Marco, Anne is becoming more and more anxious and upset. She is still more than 20 pounds overweight from her pregnancy, 6 months after having the baby. She thought she'd be back to her pre-pregnancy figure by now, but apparently it takes at least a year. She must stop looking at the tabloids at the grocery store checkout and comparing herself to all those celebrity moms with their personal trainers who look terrific after mere weeks. But even at her best, Anne could never compete with the likes of Cynthia, her taller, shapelier neighbor, with her long legs, nipped-in waist, and big breasts, her porcelain skin and tumbling jet-black hair. And Cynthia always dressed to kill, in high heels and sexy clothes, even for a dinner party at home with one other couple. Anne can't focus on the conversation around her. She tunes it out and stares at the carved marble fireplace, exactly like the one in her own living dining room on the other side of the common wall that Anne and Marco share with Cynthia and Graham. They live in attached brick row houses, typical of this city in upstate New York, solidly built in the late 19th century. All the houses in the row are similar, Italianate, restored, expensive, except that Anne and Marco's is at the end of the row, and each reflects slight differences in decoration and taste. Each one is a small masterpiece. Anne reaches clumsily for her cell phone on the dining table and checks the time. It is almost 1 o'clock in the morning. She'd checked on the baby at midnight. Marco had gone to check on her at 12:30. Then he'd gone out for a cigarette on the back patio with Cynthia, while Anne and Graham sat rather awkwardly at the littered dining table, making stilted conversation. She should have gone out to the backyard with them. There might have been a breeze. But she hadn't, because Graham didn't like to be around cigarette smoke, and it would have been rude, or at least inconsiderate, to leave Graham there all alone at his own dinner party. So, for reasons of propriety, she had stayed. Graham, a wasp like herself, is impeccably polite. Why he married a tart like Cynthia is a mystery. Cynthia and Marco had come back in from the patio a few minutes ago, and Anne desperately wants to leave, even if everyone else is still having fun. She glances at the baby monitor sitting at the end of the table, its small red light glowing like the tip of a cigarette. The video screen is smashed. She dropped it a couple of days ago, and Marco hadn't gotten around to replacing it yet, but the audio is still working. Suddenly she has doubts, feels the wrongness of it all. Who goes to a dinner party next door and leaves her baby alone in the house? What kind of mother does such a thing? She feels the familiar agony set in. She is not a good mother. So what if the sitter canceled? They should have brought Cora with them, put her in her portable playpen. But Cynthia had said no children. It was to be an adult evening for Graham's birthday, which is another reason Anne has come to dislike Cynthia, who was once a good friend. Cynthia is not baby-friendly. Who says that a 6-month-old baby isn't welcome at a dinner party? How had Anne ever let Marco persuade her that it was okay? It was irresponsible. She wonders what the other mothers in her mom's group would think if she ever told them. We left our 6-month-old baby home alone and went to a party next door. She imagines all their jaws dropping in shock, the uncomfortable silence. But she will never tell them. She'd be shunned. She and Marco had argued about it before the party. When the sitter called and canceled, Anne had offered to stay home with the baby. She hadn't wanted to go to the dinner anyway, but Marco was having none of it. "You can't just stay home," he insisted when they argued about it in their kitchen. "I'm fine staying home," she said, her voice lowered. She didn't want Cynthia to hear them through the shared wall, arguing about going to her party. "It will be good for you to get out," Marco countered, lowering his own voice, and then he'd added, "You know what the doctor said." All night long she's been trying to decide whether that last comment was mean-spirited or self-interested, or whether he was simply trying to help. Finally she'd given in. Marco persuaded her that with the monitor on next door they could hear the baby any time she stirred or woke. They would check on her every half hour. Nothing bad would happen. It is 1 o'clock. Should she check on Cora now, or just try to get Marco to leave? She wants to go home to bed. She wants this night to end. She pulls her husband's arm. "Marco," she urges, "we should leave. It's 1 o'clock. "Oh, don't go yet," Cynthia says. "It's not that late." She obviously doesn't want the party to be over. She doesn't want Marco to leave. She wouldn't mind at all if Anne left, though, Anne is pretty sure. "Maybe not for you," Anne says, and she manages to sound a little stiff, even though she's drunk, "but I have to be up early to feed the baby." "Poor you," Cynthia says, and for some reason this infuriates Anne. Cynthia has no children, nor has she ever wanted any. She and Graham are childless by choice. Getting Marco to leave the party is difficult. He seems determined to stay. He's having too much fun, but Anne is growing anxious. "Just one more," Marco says to Cynthia, holding up his glass, avoiding his wife's eyes. He is in a strangely boisterous mood tonight. It seems almost forced. Anne wonders why. He's been quiet lately, at home, distracted, even moody. But tonight, with Cynthia, he's the life of the party. For some time now, Anne has sensed that something is wrong, if only he would tell her what it is. He isn't telling her much of anything these days. He's shutting her out. Or maybe he's withdrawing from her because of her depression, her baby blues. He's disappointed in her. Who isn't? Tonight he clearly prefers the beautiful, bubbly, sparkly Cynthia. Anne notices the time and loses all patience. I'm going to go. I was supposed to check on the baby at 1. She looks at Marco. You stay as late as you like, she adds, her voice tight. Marco looks sharply at her, his eyes glittering. Suddenly Anne thinks he doesn't seem that drunk at all, but she feels dizzy. Are they going to argue about this? In front of the neighbors? Really? Anne begins to glance around for her purse, gathers up the baby monitor, realizes then that it's plugged into the wall, and bends over to unplug it, aware of everyone at the table silently staring at her fat ass. Well, let them. She feels like they're ganging up on her, seeing her as a spoil sport. Tears start to burn, and she fights them back. She does not want to burst into tears in front of everyone. Cynthia and Graham don't know about her postpartum depression. They wouldn't understand. Anne and Marco haven't told anyone, with the exception of Anne's mother. Anne has recently confided in her. She knows that her mother won't tell anyone, not even her father. Anne doesn't want anyone else to know, and she suspects Marco doesn't either, although he hasn't said as much. But pretending all the time is exhausting. While her back is turned, she hears Marco's change of heart in the tone of his voice. You're right, it's late. We should go, he says. She hears him set his wine glass on the table behind her. Anne turns around, brushing the hair out of her eyes with the back of her hand. She desperately needs a haircut. She gives a fake smile and says, Next time it's our turn to host, and adds silently, You can come to our house, where our child lives with us, and I hope she cries all night and spoils your evening. I'll be sure to invite you when she's teething. They leave quickly after that. They have no baby gear to gather up, just themselves, Anne's purse, and the baby monitor, which she shoves into it. Cynthia looks annoyed at their swift departure. Graham is neutral, and they make their way out the impressively heavy front door and down the steps. Anne grabs hold of the elaborately carved handrail to help her keep her balance. It is just a few short paces along the sidewalk until they are at their own front stairs, with a similar handrail and an equally impressive front door. Anne is walking slightly ahead of Marco, not speaking. She may not speak to him for the rest of the night. She marches up the steps and stops dead. What? Marco says, coming up behind her, his voice tense. Anne is staring. The front door is ajar. It is open about 3 inches. I know I locked it, Anne says, her voice shrill. Marco says tersely, Maybe you forgot. You've had a lot to drink. But Anne isn't listening. She's inside and running up the staircase and down the hall to the baby's room, with Marco right at her heels. When she gets to the baby's room and sees the empty crib, she screams. 2. Anne feels her scream inside her own head and reverberating off the walls. Her scream is everywhere. Then she falls silent and stands in front of the empty crib, rigid, her hand to her mouth. Marco fumbles with the light switch. They both stare at the empty crib where their baby should be. It is impossible that she is not there. There is no way Cora could have gotten out of the crib by herself. She is barely 6 months old. Call the police, Anne whispers, then throws up, the vomit cascading over her fingers and onto the hardwood floor as she bends over. The baby's room, painted a soft butter yellow with stencils of baby lambs frolicking on the walls, immediately fills with the smell of bile and panic. Marco doesn't move. Anne looks up at him. He is paralyzed, in shock, staring at the empty crib as if he can't believe it. Anne sees the fear and guilt in his eyes and starts to wail, a horrible keening sound, like an animal in pain. Marco still doesn't budge. Anne bolts across the hall to their bedroom, grabs the phone off the bedside table and dials 911, her hands shaking, getting vomit all over the phone. Marco finally snaps out of it. She can hear him walking rapidly around the second floor of the house, while she stares across the hall at the empty crib. He checks the bathroom at the top of the stairs, then passes quickly by her on his way to search the spare bedroom and then the last room down the hall, the one they have turned into an office. But even as he does, Anne wonders in a detached way why he is looking there. It's as if part of her mind has split off and is thinking logically. It's not like their baby is mobile on her own. She is not in the bathroom, or the spare bedroom, or the office. Someone has taken her. When the emergency operator answers, Anne cries, "Someone has taken our baby!" She is barely able to calm herself enough to answer the operator's questions. "I understand, ma'am. Try to stay calm. The police are on their way," the operator assures her. Anne hangs up the phone. Her whole body is trembling. She feels like she is going to be sick again. It occurs to her how it will look. They'd left the baby alone in the house. Was that illegal? It must be. How will they explain it? Marco appears at the bedroom door, pale and sick-looking. "This is your fault!" Anne screams, wild-eyed, and pushes past him. She rushes into the bathroom at the top of the stairs and throws up again, this time into the pedestal sink, then washes the mess from her shaking hands and rinses her mouth. She catches a glimpse of herself in the mirror. Marco is standing right behind her. Their eyes meet in the mirror. "I'm sorry," he whispers. "I'm so sorry. It's my fault." And he is sorry. She can tell. Even so, Anne brings her hand up and smashes at the reflection of his face in the mirror. The mirror shatters, and she breaks down, sobbing. He tries to take her in his arms, but she pushes him away and runs downstairs. Her hand is bleeding, leaving a trail of blood along the banister. An air of unreality permeates everything that happens next. Anne and Marco's comfortable home immediately becomes a crime scene. Anne is sitting on the sofa in the living room. Someone has placed a blanket around her shoulders, but she's still trembling. She is in shock. Police cars are parked on the street outside the house, their red lights flashing, pulsing through the front window and circling the pale walls. Anne sits immobile on the sofa and stares ahead as if hypnotized by them. Marco, his voice breaking, has given the police a quick description of the baby. 6 months old, blonde, blue eyes, about 16 pounds, wearing a disposable diaper and a plain, pale pink onesie. A light summer baby blanket, solid white, is also missing from the crib. The house is swarming with uniformed police officers. They fan out and methodically begin to search the house. Some of them wear latex gloves and carry evidence kits. Anne and Marco's fast, frantic race through the house in the short minutes before the police arrived had turned up nothing. The forensic team is moving slowly. Clearly, they are not looking for Cora. They are looking for evidence. The baby is already gone. Marco sits down on the sofa next to Anne and puts his arm around her, holds her close. She wants to pull away, but she doesn't. She lets his arm stay there. How would it look if she pulled away? She can smell that he's been drinking. Anne now blames herself. It's her fault. She wants to blame Marco, but she agreed to leave the baby alone. She should have stayed home. No, she should have brought Cora with them next door, to hell with Cynthia. She doubts Cynthia would have actually thrown them out and had no party for Graham at all. This realization comes too late. They will be judged by the police and by everybody else. Serves them right, leaving their baby alone. She would think that, too, if it had happened to someone else. She knows how judgmental mothers are, how good it feels to sit in judgment of someone else. She thinks of her own mother's group, meeting with their babies once a week in one another's homes for coffee and gossip. What they will say about her. Someone else has arrived. A composed man in a well-cut dark suit. The uniformed officers treat him with deference. Anne looks up, meets his piercing blue eyes, and wonders who he is. He approaches and sits down in one of the armchairs across from Anne and Marco and introduces himself as Detective Razvak. Then he leans forward. "Tell me what happened." Anne immediately forgets the detective's name, or rather it hasn't registered at all. She only catches Detective. She looks at him, encouraged by the frank intelligence behind his eyes. He will help them. He will help them get Cora back. She tries to think, but she can't think. She is frantic and numb at the same time. She simply stares into the detective's sharp eyes and lets Marco do the talking.
"We were next door," Marco begins, clearly agitated, "at the neighbor's."
Then he stops.
"Yes?"
the detective says. Marco hesitates.
"Where was the baby?"
the detective asks. Marco doesn't answer. He doesn't want to say. Anne, pulling herself together, answers for him, the tears spilling down her face.
"We left her here, in her crib, with the monitor on."
She watches the detective for his reaction. What awful parents. But he betrays nothing.
"We had the monitor on over there, and we checked on her constantly, every half hour."
She glances at Marco.
"We never thought..."
But she can't finish. Her hand goes to her mouth. Her fingers press against her lips.
"When was the last time you checked on her?"
the detective asks, taking a small notebook from the inside pocket of his suit jacket.
"I checked on her at midnight," Anne says. "I remember the time. We were checking on her every half hour, and it was my turn. She was fine. She was sleeping."
"I checked on her again at 12:30, Marco says. "You're absolutely certain of the time?"
the detective asks. Marco nods. He is staring at his feet.
"And that was the last time anyone checked on her, before you came home?"
"Yes," Marco says, looking up at the detective, running a nervous hand through his dark hair.
"I went to check on her at 12:30. It was my turn. We were keeping to a schedule."
Anne nods.
"How much have you had to drink tonight?"
the detective asks Marco. Marco flushes. "They were having a small dinner party next door."
"I had a few," he admits.
The detective turns to Anne.
"Have you had anything to drink tonight, Mrs. Conti?"
Her face burns. Nursing mothers aren't supposed to drink. She wants to lie.
"I had some wine with dinner. I don't know how much exactly," she says. "It was a dinner party."
She wonders how drunk she looks, what this detective must think of her. She feels like he can see right through her. She remembers the vomit upstairs in the baby's room. Can he smell drink on her, the way she can smell it on Marco? She remembers the shattered mirror in the upstairs bathroom, her bloodied hand now wrapped in a clean dish towel. She's ashamed of how they must look to him, drunken parents who abandoned their 6-month-old daughter. She wonders if they will be charged with anything.
"How is that even relevant?"
Marco says to the detective.
"It might affect the reliability of your observations,"
the detective says evenly. He is not judgmental. He is merely after the facts, it seems.
"What time did you leave the party?"
he asks.
"It was almost 1:30, Anne answers. "I kept checking the time on my cell. I wanted to go. I should have checked on her at 1. It was my turn. But I thought we'd be leaving any minute, and I was trying to get Marco to hurry up."
She feels agonizingly guilty. If she had checked on her daughter at 1 o'clock, would she be gone now? But then, there were so many ways this could have been prevented.
"You placed the call to 911 at 1:27, the detective says.
"The front door was open," Anne says, remembering.
"The front door was open?" the detective repeats.
"It was open 3 or 4 inches. I'm sure I locked it behind me when I checked on her at midnight," Anne says.
"How sure?"
Anne thinks about it. Was she sure? She had been positive when she saw the open front door that she'd locked it. But now, with what had happened, how can she be sure of anything? She turns to her husband.
"Are you sure you didn't leave the door open?"
"I'm sure," he says curtly. "I never used the front door. I was going through the back to check on her, remember?" "You used the back door," the detective repeats.
"I may not have locked it every time,"
Marco admits, and covers his face with his hands. Detective Razback observes the couple closely. A baby is missing, taken from her crib, if the parents, Marco and Anne Conti, are to be believed, between approximately 12:30 a.m. and 1:27 a.m. by a person or persons unknown, while the parents were at a party next door. The front door had been found partly open. The back door might have been left unlocked by the father. It had, in fact, been found closed but unlocked when the police arrived. There is no denying the distress of the mother, and of the father, who looks badly shaken, but the whole situation doesn't feel right. Razback wonders what is really going on. Detective Jennings waves him over silently. "Excuse me," Detective Razback says, and leaves the stricken parents for a moment. "What is it?" Razback asks quietly. Jennings holds up a small vial of pills. "Found these in the bathroom cabinet," he says. Razback takes the clear plastic container from Jennings and studies the label. Anne Conti, sertraline, 50 milligrams. Sertraline, Razback knows, is a powerful antidepressant. "The bathroom mirror upstairs is smashed," Jennings tells him. Razback nods. He hasn't been upstairs yet. "Anything else?" Jennings shakes his head. "Nothing so far. House looks clean. Nothing else taken, apparently. We'll know more from forensics in a few hours." "Okay," Razback says, handing the vial of pills back to Jennings. He returns to the couple on the sofa and resumes his questioning. He looks at the husband. "Marco, is it okay if I call you Marco? What did you do after you checked on the baby at 12:30?
"I went back to the party," Marco says. "I had a cigarette in the neighbor's backyard."
"Were you alone when you had your cigarette?"
"No. Cynthia came out with me."
Marco flushes, Razback notices. "She's the neighbor who had us over for dinner." Razback turns his attention to the wife. She's an attractive woman, with fine features and glossy brown hair, but right now she looks colorless.
"You don't smoke, Mrs. Conti?"
"No, I don't. But Cynthia does," Anne says. "I was sitting at the dining room table with Graham, her husband. He hates cigarette smoke, and it was his birthday, and I thought it would be rude to leave him alone inside." And then, inexplicably, she volunteers, "Cynthia had been flirting with Marco all evening, and I felt bad for Graham."
"I see," Razback says. He studies the husband, who looks utterly miserable. He also looks nervous and guilty. Razback turns to him.
"So you were outside in the backyard next door shortly after 12:30. Any idea how long you were out there?"
Marco shakes his head helplessly. "Maybe 15 minutes, give or take."
"Did you see anything? Or hear anything?"
"What do you mean?"
The husband seems to be in some kind of shock. He is slurring his words slightly. Razback wonders just how much alcohol he's had. Razback spells it out for him.
"Someone apparently took your baby sometime between 12:30 and 1:27. You were outside in the backyard next door for a few minutes shortly after 12:30.
He watches the husband, waits for him to put it together.
"To my mind, it's unlikely that anyone would carry a baby out your front door in the middle of the night."
"But the front door was open," Anne says. "I didn't see anything," Marco says.
"There's a lane running behind the houses on this side of the street," Detective Razback says.
Marco nods.
"Did you notice anyone using the lane at that time? Did you hear anything? A car?"
I don't think so," Marco says.
"I'm sorry. I didn't see or hear anything."
He covers his face with his hands again.
"I wasn't paying attention."
Detective Razback had already checked out the area quickly before coming inside and interviewing the parents. He thinks it unlikely, but not impossible, that a stranger would carry a sleeping child out the front door of a house on a street like this one and risk being seen. The houses are attached row houses set close to the sidewalk. The street is well lit, and there is a fair bit of vehicular and foot traffic, even late at night. So it is odd, Perhaps he's being deliberately misled that the front door was open. The forensics team is dusting it for fingerprints now, but somehow Razback doesn't think they'll find anything. The back holds more potential. Most of the houses, including the Contis, have a single detached garage opening onto the lane, behind the house. The backyards are long and narrow, fenced in between, and most, including the Contis, have trees and shrubs and gardens. It is relatively dark back there. There are no street lights as there are in the front. It's a dark night with no moon. Whoever has taken the child, if he had come out the Conti's back door, would only have had to walk across the backyard to the garage, with access from there to the lane. The chances of being seen carrying an abducted child out the back door to a waiting vehicle are much less than the chances of being seen carrying an abducted child out the front door. The house, yard, and garage are being thoroughly searched by Razback's team. So far, they have found no sign of the missing baby. The Conti's garage is empty, and the garage door has been left wide open to the lane. It's possible that even if someone had been sitting out back on the patio next door, he or she might not have noticed anything. But not likely. Which narrows the window of the abduction to between approximately 12:45 and 1:27 a.m. "Are you aware that your motion detector isn't working?" Razback asks. "What?" the husband says, startled. "You have a motion detector on your back door, a light that should go on when someone approaches it. Are you aware that it isn't working?"
"No,"
the wife whispers. The husband shakes his head vigorously. "No, it was working when I checked on her. What's wrong with it?" "The bulb has been loosened." Detective Razback watches the parents carefully. He pauses. "It leads me to believe that the child was taken out the back, to the garage, and away, probably in a vehicle, via the lane." He waits, but neither the husband nor the wife says anything. The wife is shaking, he notices. "Where is your car?" Razback asks, leaning forward.
"Our car?"
Anne echoes. 3. Razback waits for their answer. She answers first.
"It's on the street."
"You park on the street when you've got a garage in back?" Razback asks.
"Everybody does that," Anne answers. "It's easier than going through the lane, especially in the winter. Most people get a parking permit and just park on the street."
"I see," Razback says.
"Why?" the wife asks. "What does it matter?"
Razback explains. "It probably made it easier for the kidnapper. If the garage was empty and the garage door was left open, it would be relatively easy for someone to back a car in and put the baby in the car while the car was in the garage out of sight. It would obviously be more difficult, certainly riskier, if the garage already had a car in it. The kidnapper would run the risk of being seen in the lane with the baby." Razback notices that the husband has turned another shade paler, if that is even possible. His pallor is quite striking. "We're hoping we will get some shoe prints or tire tracks from the garage," Razback adds.
"You make it sound like this was planned," the mother says.
"Do you think it wasn't?" Razback asks her.
I don't know. I guess I thought Cora was taken because we left her alone in the house, that it was a crime of opportunity, like if someone had snatched her from the park when I wasn't looking."
Razback nods, as if trying to understand it from her point of view. "I see what you mean," he says. "For example, a mother leaves her child playing in the park while she fetches an ice cream from the ice cream truck. The child is snatched while her back is turned. It happens." He pauses. "But surely you realize the difference here."
She looks back at him blankly. He has to remember that she is probably in shock, but he sees this sort of thing all the time. It is his job.
He is analytical, not at all sentimental. He must be, if he is to be effective. He will find this child, dead or alive, and he will find whoever took her. He tells the mother, his voice matter-of-fact, "The difference is, whoever took your baby probably knew she was alone in the house."
The parents look at each other.
"But nobody knew,"
the mother whispers. "Of course," Razbak adds, "it is possible that she might have been taken even if you were sound asleep in your own bedroom. We don't know for sure."
The parents would like to believe that it isn't their fault, after all, for leaving their baby alone, that this might have happened anyway. Razbak asks,
"Do you always leave the garage door open like that?"
The husband answers,
"Sometimes." "Wouldn't you close the garage door at night, to prevent theft?"
"We don't keep anything valuable in the garage," the husband says. "If the car's in there, we generally lock the door, but we don't keep much in there otherwise. All my tools are in the basement. This is a nice neighborhood, but people break into garages here all the time, so what's the point of locking it?"
Razbak nods. Then he asks, "What kind of car do you have?"
"It's an Audi," Marco says.
"Why?"
"I'd like to have a look. May I have the keys?"
Razbak asks.
Marco and Anne regard each other in confusion. Then Marco gets up and goes to a side table near the front door and grabs a set of keys from a bowl. He hands them over to the detective silently and sits back down.
"Thank you,"
Razbak says. Then he leans forward and says deliberately,
"We will find out who did this."
They stare back at him, meeting his eyes, the mother's entire face swollen from crying, the father's eyes puffy and bloodshot with distress and drink, his face pasty. Razbak nods to Jennings, and together they leave the house to check the car. The couple sit on the sofa silently and watch them go. Anne doesn't know what to make of the detective. All this about their car. He seems to be insinuating something. She knows that when a wife goes missing, the husband is usually the prime suspect, and probably vice versa. But when a child goes missing, are the parents usually the prime suspects? Surely not. Who could harm their own child? Besides, they both have solid alibis. They can be accounted for by Cynthia and Graham. There is obviously no way they could have taken and hidden their own daughter. And why would they? She is aware that the neighborhood is being searched, that there are police officers going up and down the streets, knocking on doors, interviewing people roused from their beds. Marco has provided the police with a recent photo of Cora, taken just a few days ago. The photo shows a happy, blonde baby girl with big blue eyes, smiling up at the camera. Anne is angry at Marco. She wants to scream at him, pummel him with her fists, but their house is full of police officers, so she doesn't dare. And when she looks at his pale, bleak face, she sees that he is already blaming himself. She knows she can't survive this on her own. She turns to him and collapses into his chest, sobbing. His arms come up around her, and he hugs her tightly. She can feel him shaking, can feel the painful thumping of his heart. She tells herself that together they will get through this. The police will find Cora. They will get their daughter back. And if they don't, she will never forgive him. Detective Razbak, in his lightweight summer suit, steps out the front door of the Contis' house and down the steps into the hot summer night, closely followed by Detective Jennings. They have worked together before. They have each seen some things that they would like to be able to forget. Together they walk toward the opposite side of the street, lined with cars parked bumper to bumper. Razbak presses a button, and the headlights of the Audi flash briefly. Already the neighbors are out on their front steps in their pajamas and summer bathrobes. Now they watch as Razbak and Jennings walk toward the Conti's car. Razbak hopes that someone on this street might know something, might have seen something, and will come forward. Jennings says, his voice low, "What's your take?" Razbak answers quietly, "I'm not optimistic." Razbak pulls on a pair of latex gloves that Jennings hands him and opens the door on the driver's side. He looks briefly inside, and then silently walks to the back of the car. Jennings follows. Razvak pops open the trunk. The two detectives look inside. It's empty, and very clean. The car is just over a year old. It still looks new. "Love that new car smell," Jennings says. Clearly the child isn't there. That doesn't mean she hadn't been there, however briefly. Perhaps forensic investigation will reveal fibers from a pink onesie, DNA from the baby, a hair, a trace of drool, or maybe blood. Without a body, they will have a tough case to make, but no parents ever put their baby in the trunk with good intentions. If they find any trace of the missing child in the trunk, he will see that the parents rot in hell. Because if there's anything Razvak has learned in his years on the job, it is that people are capable of almost anything. Razvak is aware that the baby could have gone missing at any time before the dinner party. He has yet to question the parents in detail about the previous day, has yet to determine who, other than the parents, last saw the child alive. But he will find out. Perhaps there is a mother's helper who comes in, or a cleaning lady, or a neighbor, someone who saw the baby, alive and well, earlier that day. He will establish when the baby was last known to be alive and work forward from there. This leaving the monitor on, checking every half hour while they dined next door, the disabled motion detector, the open front door, it could all simply be an elaborate fiction, a carefully constructed fabrication of the parents, to provide them with an alibi, to throw the authorities off the scent. They might have killed the baby at any time earlier that day, either deliberately or by accident, and put her in the trunk and disposed of the body before going to the party next door. Or, if they were still thinking clearly, they might not have put her in the trunk at all, but in the car seat. A dead baby might not look that different from a sleeping baby, depending on how they killed her. Razvak knows that he's a cynic. He hadn't started out that way. He says to Jennings, "Bring in the cadaver dogs." 4. Razvak returns to the house while Jennings checks in with the officers on the street. Razvak sees Anne sobbing on the end of the sofa, a woman police officer sitting beside her with her arm across Anne's shoulders. Marco is not with her. Drawn by the smell of fresh coffee, Razvak makes his way to the kitchen at the back of the long, narrow house. The kitchen has obviously been remodeled, and fairly recently. It is all very high-end, from the white cabinetry to the expensive appliances and granite counters. Marco is in the kitchen, standing by the coffee maker with his head down, waiting for it to finish brewing. He looks up when Razvak comes in, then turns away, perhaps embarrassed by such an obvious attempt to sober up. There is an awkward silence. Then Marco asks quietly, without taking his eyes off the coffee maker, "What do you think has happened to her?" Razvak says, "I don't know yet, but I'll find out." Marco lifts the coffee pot and pours coffee into three china mugs on the spotless stone counter. Razvak notices that Marco's hand trembles as he pours. Marco offers the detective one of the mugs, which Razvak accepts gratefully. Marco leaves the kitchen and returns to the living room with the other two mugs. Razvak watches him go, steeling himself for what is ahead. Child abduction cases are always difficult. They create a media circus, for one thing, and they almost never end well. He knows he will have to apply pressure to this couple. It's part of the job. Each time Razvak is called out on a case, he never knows what to expect. Nonetheless, each time he unravels the puzzle, he is never surprised. His capacity for surprise seems to have evaporated. But he is always curious. He always wants to know. Razvak helps himself to the milk and sugar that Marco has left out for him, and then pauses in the doorway of the kitchen with his coffee mug in his hand.
From where he stands, he can see the dining table and the sideboard near the kitchen, both obviously antiques. Beyond that, he can see the sofa, upholstered in dark green velvet, and the backs of Anne and Marco Conti's heads. To the right of them is a marble fireplace, and above the mantelpiece hangs a large oil painting. Razbak doesn't know what it is a painting of, exactly. The sofa faces the front window, but more immediately, in front of the sofa, there is a coffee table and, across from that, two deep, comfortable armchairs. Razbak makes his way into the living room and resumes his previous seat across from the couple, in the armchair nearest the fireplace. He notes how Marco's hands still shake as he brings the mug to his mouth. Anne simply holds the cup in her hands on her lap, as if she doesn't realize it's there. She has stopped crying, for the moment. The lurid lights of the police cars parked outside still play across the walls. The forensic team goes about its tasks in the house quietly, efficiently. The atmosphere inside the house is busy but subdued, grim. Razbak has a delicate task before him. He must convey to this couple that he is working for them, doing everything possible to find their missing baby, which he is, along with the rest of the police force, even while he knows that in most cases, when a child goes missing like this, it is the parents who are responsible. And there are factors here that certainly make him suspicious. But he will keep an open mind.
"I'm very sorry," Razbak begins. "I can't even imagine how hard this is for you."
Anne looks up at him. The sympathy makes her eyes instantly well up with more tears. "Who would take our baby?" she asks plaintively.
"That's what we have to find out," Razbak says, setting his mug on the coffee table and taking out his notebook. "This may seem too obvious a question to ask, but do you have any idea who might have taken her?"
They both stare at him. Such an idea is preposterous. And yet, here they are.
"Have you noticed anyone hanging around lately? Anyone showing interest in your baby?"
They both shake their heads.
"Do you have any idea, at all, who might want to do you harm?"
He looks from Anne to Marco. The two parents shake their heads again, equally at a loss.
"Please, give it some thought," Razbak says. "Take your time. There has to be a reason. There's always a reason. We just have to find out what it is."
Marco looks like he's about to speak, then thinks better of it.
"What is it?" Razbak asks. "This is no time to hold back."
"Your parents," Marco says finally, turning to his wife.
"What about my parents?"
she says, clearly surprised. "They have money."
"So?"
She doesn't seem to understand what he's getting at. "They have a lot of money," Marco says. "Here we go," Razbak thinks. Anne looks at her husband as if dumbfounded. She is, possibly, an excellent actress.
"What do you mean?" she says. "You don't think someone took her for..."
Razbak watches the two of them carefully. The expression on her face changes.
"That would be good," she says, looking up at him. "Wouldn't it? If all they want is money, I could get my baby back. They won't hurt her."
The hope in her voice is heartbreaking. Razbak is almost convinced that she has nothing to do with this.
"She must be so scared," she says, and then she falls completely apart, sobbing uncontrollably.
Razbak wants to ask her about her parents. Time is of the essence in kidnapping cases. Instead, he turns to Marco.
"Who were her parents?" Razbak asks.
"Alice and Richard Dries," Marco tells him. "Richard is her stepfather." Razbak writes it down in his notebook. Anne regains control over herself and says again,
"My parents have a lot of money."
"How much money?" Razbak asks.
"I don't know exactly," Anne says. "Millions."
"Can you be a little more precise?" Razbak asks.
"I think they're worth somewhere around 15 million,
Anne says.
"But it's not like anybody knows that."
Razbak looks at Marco.
His face is completely blank.
"I want to call my mother,"
Anne says. She glances at the clock on the mantelpiece, and Razbak follows her gaze. It's 2:15 in the morning. Anne has a complicated relationship with her parents. When Marco and Anne are having issues with them, which is frequently the case, Marco tells her that her relationship with them is fucked up. Maybe it is, but they are the only parents she has. She needs them. She makes things work the best she can. But it isn't easy. Marco comes from an entirely different kind of background. His family is large and squabbling. They yell good-naturedly when they see one another, which isn't often. His parents emigrated from Italy to New York before Marco was born and own a dry-cleaning and tailoring business. They have no money to speak of, but they get by. They are not overly involved in Marco's life, as Anne's wealthy parents are in hers. Marco and his four siblings have had to fend for themselves from a young age, pushed out of the nest. Marco has been living his life on his own, and on his own terms, since he was 18. He put himself through school. He sees his parents occasionally, but they are not a big part of his life. He isn't exactly from the wrong side of the tracks in anybody's book, except for Anne's parents and their well-heeled friends at the Grand View Golf and Country Club. Marco comes from a middle-class, law-abiding family of hard-working people who have done well enough, but no better than that. None of Anne's friends from college or from her job at the art gallery think Marco is from the wrong side of the tracks. It is only old money that would see him that way. And Anne's mother is from old money. Anne's father, Richard Dries, actually her stepfather, her own father died tragically when she was 4 years old, is a successful businessman, but her mother, Alice, has millions. Her wealthy parents enjoy their money, their rich friends, the house in one of the finest parts of the city, the membership at the Grand View Golf and Country Club, the luxury cars and five-star vacations, sending Anne to a private girls' school, then to a good university. The older her father gets, the more he likes to pretend that he's earned all that money. But it isn't true. It's gone to his head. He's become quite full of himself. When Anne took up with Marco, her parents acted as if the world were coming to an end. Marco looked like the quintessential bad boy. He was dangerously attractive, fair-skinned for an Italian, with dark hair, brooding eyes, and a bit of a rebellious look, especially when he hadn't shaved. But his eyes lit up warmly when he saw Anne, and he had that million-dollar smile. And the way he called her baby, she couldn't resist him. The first time he showed up at her parents' house to pick her up for a date was one of the defining moments of Anne's young adulthood. She was 22. Her mother had been telling her about a nice young man, a lawyer, the son of a friend, who was interested in meeting her. Anne had explained, impatiently, that she was already seeing Marco. "Yes, but," her mother said. "But what?" Anne said, folding her arms across her chest. "You can't be serious about him," her mother said. Anne can still remember the expression on her mother's face, dismay, embarrassment. She was thinking about how it would look, thinking about how she would explain to her friends that her daughter was dating a young man who came from nothing, who worked as a bartender in the Italian part of the city and rode a motorcycle. Her mother would forget about the business degree Marco had earned at the same university that was considered good enough for their daughter. They wouldn't see how his working his way through school at night was admirable. Maybe nobody would ever be good enough for her parents' little girl. And then it was perfect. Marco had roared up on his Ducati, and Anne had flown out of her parents' house and straight into Marco's arms, her mother watching from behind the curtains. He kissed her hard, still straddling the bike, and handed her his spare helmet. She climbed on, and they roared away, manicured gravel spitting up in their wake.
That was the moment she'd decided she was in love. But you aren't 22 forever. You grow up. Things change.
I want to call my mother,
Anne repeats now.
So much has happened. Has it been less than an hour since they returned home to an empty crib?
Margot grabs the phone and hands it to her, then sits back down on the sofa with his arms crossed in front of him, looking tense. Anne dials the phone. She starts to cry again before she's even finished dialing the number. The phone rings and her mother answers.
Mom?
Anne says, dissolving into incoherent sobbing. Anne? What's wrong? Anne finally gets the words out.
Someone has taken Cora.
Oh, my God, her mother says.
The police are here,
Anne tells her.
Can you come?
We'll be right there, Anne, her mother says. You hold on. Your father and I are coming. Anne hangs up the phone and cries. Her parents will come. They have always helped her, even when they're angry at her. They will be angry now, at her and Marco, but especially at Marco. They love Cora, their only grandchild. What will they think when they hear what she and Marco have done?
They're on their way,
Anne says to Marco and the detective. She looks at Marco, then looks away. 5. Marco feels like an outcast. It's a feeling he often gets when Anne's parents are in the room. Even now, with Cora missing, he is ignored, while the three of them, his distraught wife, her always composed mother, and her overbearing father, slip into their familiar three-person alliance. Sometimes their exclusion of him is subtle, sometimes not. But then again, he knew what he was getting into when he married her. He thought it was a deal he could live with. He stands at the side of the living room, useless, and watches Anne. She's seated in the middle of the sofa, her mother at her side, pulling Anne into her for comfort. Her father is more aloof, sitting up straight, patting his daughter on the shoulder. No one looks at Marco. No one offers him comfort. Marco feels out of place in his own home. But worse than that, he feels sick, horrified. All he wants is his little Cora back in her crib. He wants all of this never to have happened. He feels the detective's eyes on him. He alone is paying attention to Marco. Marco deliberately ignores him, even though he knows he probably shouldn't. Marco knows he is a suspect. The detective has been insinuating as much ever since he got here. Marco has overheard the officers in the house whispering about bringing in the cadaver dogs. He isn't stupid. They would only do that if they thought Cora was dead before she left the house. The police obviously must think he and Anne killed their own baby. Let them bring in the dogs. He's not afraid. Maybe this is the kind of thing the police deal with on a regular basis, parents who kill their children, but he could never hurt his baby. Cora means everything to him. She has been the one bright light in his life, the one reliable, constant source of joy, especially these last few months as things have fallen steadily apart and as Anne has become increasingly lost and depressed. He hardly knows his wife anymore. What happened to the beautiful, engaging woman he married? Everything has been going to shit. But he and Cora have had a happy little bond of their own, the two of them, waiting it out, waiting for Mommy to return to normal. Anne's parents will hold him in more contempt than ever now. They will forgive Anne quickly. They will forgive her almost anything, even abandoning their baby to a predator, even this. But they will never forgive him. They will be stoic in the face of this adversity. They are always stoic, unlike their emotional daughter. Perhaps they will even rescue Anne and Marco from their own mistakes. That is what they like to do best. Even now he can see Anne's father looking off over the heads of Anne and her mother, his brow furrowed, concentrating on the problem Marco created, and on how he might solve it. Thinking about how he can rise to this challenge and come out triumphant. Maybe he can show Marco up one more time when it really counts.
Marco despises his father-in-law. It's mutual. But the important thing now is to get Cora back. That's all that matters. They're a complicated, screwed-up family in Marco's view, but they all love Cora. He blinks back a fresh surge of tears. Detective